most original and creative talent in our business, would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, here we go again. This is Buck Benny speaking. I'm here joined with Terry Phillips and with Kathy Fuller-Seeley to talk to you guys again. It's great to see you. This is our presentation of Orson Welles, and it's the Orson Welles Commentaries, and this one focuses on some rumors that are going around politically, and it also focuses on a fairy tale story that Orson had said he was going to present the previous week, but ran out of time with all the jazz musicians and the jazz pieces. I hope you enjoyed that one too, by the way. I did, if you didn't listen to it yet, go back and listen to last week's, in that I did do exactly what I said I was going to do. I was able to go through the presentation where Orson Welles talks about different classical, modern classical composers. And each time he mentions a name, I inserted a little 2 minute or less clip of their piece that they did. And it turned out, I mean, it took a lot of time. It probably took me 2 hours to pull that together. But in the end, I listened to it and I really liked it, that how it all came together. I think Orson would have been very happy with that, to give those all those folks a little plug as we go through and hear what they're, and the music is so diverse, and it was so interesting that some of them were featured in movies like Platoon, and they were featured in the Taxi Driver, and we had the theme, Herman, what his first name is anyway, we had his presentation of Psycho, the Prelude to Psycho, which is a really interesting piece of music. So yeah, go back and listen to that. I think it's excellent. So let's talk about this week with Orson. Let's start with Terry. Terry, what stuck out to you and what was interesting?
Well, I'll give this to you in reverse order.
Sure.
The Briar Rose tale that Orson Welles reads, one of the most famous of the Grimm's fairy tales, must have had political significance for him, because Orson Welles did not do anything in these by happenstance.
Right.
And I spent a lot of time thinking about this after listening to it.
Right.
And he maybe in 1945, if I had been listening to it, it would have connected better.
Yeah.
But, you know, all these years later, I can only guess at what he was trying to tell us, but there's definitely a political allusion here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd be curious to know whether the two of you got what he was shooting for. The first part was, as is usually the case with his commentaries, pretty on the nose, talking about nuclear weapons. And
right.
Orson Welles was famously anti-war. He was famously progressive, as we would describe him today.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1945, the mood of the country, and particularly as, you know, ratcheted up by the Red Scare, was decidedly anti-communist, anti-Russian, even though they had just been our allies in the war.
Right.
And so he was in the camp with, I don't know, well, with Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb, mm-hmm. in suggesting that the United States shouldn't be the only country with the nuclear secrets. And this was before the Soviet Union had developed its own atomic weapon.
Right.
But he was decidedly anti-war. That was the main theme of these rumors, and even suggesting that Harry Truman might run for higher office. He's president of the United States. What's he going to be, president of the UN? No, maybe he'll be, did he say president or governor of Missouri? You know, go back home, Harry, because he disagreed with his Cold War politics.
Right.
And it's amazing to me that Orson Welles had the power that he did to withstand the, you know, the McCarthyism challenges. he kept that platform for a long time.
He ended up most of the rest of the 40s and 50s, like in Europe, right? So, you know, I mean, so yeah. He didn't withstand them, just seems to me.
Right, ultimately, well. You're right. Ultimately, you're right. So do either of you have an opinion on why he chose this fairy tale?
You're right. I was kind of whip-smacked, terrified about this discussion in the first part of the show about should we preemptively use nuclear weapons on the Russians? So suddenly, this is just November 45. We have just defeated the Japanese not 2 months before. And already we're talking. It just sounded like nightmare times, a little bit the same way that 2020 sounds like nightmare times. But something I would love to play for students to say, you know, usually think you win a war. It's like winning a football game. Yay. We're all kissing each other in Times Square and going to Disney World. Just the sheer terror of what's going on. And this idea is, you know, is the UN or the Atomic Energy Commission going to be the global leaders? Mm-hmm. You know, I thought the same thing that you did, Terry, about why is he going on and on about the Sleeping Beauty, Briar Rose story? Is it that the U.S., that we should just go to sleep for 100 years and wait for somebody other than Harry Truman? Because Harry is stuck on the briars and dead in a horrific way? Or should we calm down or the whole world and wait for that Prince Charming to finally come by and wake us all up again? And it'll be because after the terror of the first part of this broadcast, everything goes to sleep. Mm-hmm. He's got such a calming way. And I almost conked out myself listening to it. So indeed, I was so struck going, why is he doing this?
And Kathy, you're right. He was kind of commenting on George Patton, who really did want to take the fight to the Soviets and subsequently MacArthur, General MacArthur, who wanted to take the fight to China.
Right.
He was definitely on the other side of that argument.
Yeah,
we should be
for sure
trying to find common ground and peace in the world.
Kind of slam on MacArthur, right, and that sort of thing throughout the course of this series. Go ahead. Well, and I thought
the moment.
It's interesting, the juxtaposition too. One thing we have to keep in mind is that the fairy story that was in here wasn't meant for this episode. It was meant for last week's episode. So it wasn't necessarily meant to juxtapose against this like it does. I think it's actually probably better that it was not used the previous week, because it would have been strange with the jazz thing to have that mixed in there anyway. And then have it as a juxtaposition between, like you're saying, the horror story and the fairy tale kind of back to back. The other thing I find hugely interesting about this is, as somebody that's kind of into history, you sort of hear, okay, it's the end of World War II. And then very quickly thereafter, Russia gets the nuclear weapon and we're into the Cold War. And it's just sort of, you sort of glossed over those 4 or 5 year period until you get into the 1950s and the Cold War is really going and so forth. This is the height of that. This is this strange in-between time between World War II and the Cold War. And to get some of his speculation on things and to realize that at this point in time, for this very short window of history, we are the only superpower at that point. There is no one else has nuclear capability but us. And what should we do with that? What should be done with that? I mean, theoretically, if we wanted to, we could have taken over the world at that point. If we started nuclear bombing tons of places, I mean, all of a sudden, if we wanted to be the Nazis, we could have taken over the entire world. And who knows if we could have kept it, but certainly we could have taken it over.
For anybody who likes to read, there's a wonderful history book written by a fellow named Paul Boyer, and it's called By the Bomb's Early Light. And it is a cultural and social history of just these months and these couple years jewelers were making, you could buy a rhinestone shaped like a mushroom cloud. Wow. And wear it. You know, the bikini bathing suit is named after the atomic tests at Bikini Atoll. Mm-hmm. The world is trying to come up. And one highlight of the book is that he says that somebody like Life magazine in either late 1945 or very early 1946 polled Americans about what did they think the future would hold. And something like 90%, some huge percent said, oh, there's going to be another world war very soon. Right. And we're all, it's going to use nuclear weapons and we're all going to die.
Yeah.
So just happiness, you're right. The sense of possible power, terror, suddenly new enemies everywhere. I've never been so glad to not be alive in a particular time period. Although COVID is right up there with it, right. But just,
We have COVID, and we also have Korea with the whole nuclear weapon and things, and
we again live in very interesting times. But as I said, if you ever want to read a book about this time period, it's a really fantastic book.
Yeah, I think perfect. And then if you want to read the Man book as well, that's interesting because I have that one. Man, that's a thick read though. So it's so interesting. So often reading the books, because of course this, going back to the Man for a second, which we just talked about, the story is what, an hour and a half film or something like that, right? So it's about 90 pages of script. They usually say it's about a page of script per minute. Well, you got a 90 page script. Well, you've got a 1,000+ page book there. And so there's so much that's left out. So like I say, an interesting read for that. And so often with our stories that are told, you're getting a little piece of it on a film. But if you go back and read the original book, it's so much more in depth and there's so much more covered so often. Anyway, we'll leave this one behind unless Terry has something else to throw out there.
The only thing I'll throw in is, as I've mentioned in our previous conversations, it's challenging both for this Orson Welles commentary and for The Man. It's always challenging to see things as they were when they first came out.
Yes.
And it's impossible to ignore our 2020 vision, mm-hmm. but our 1972 vision and 1945 vision was very different then because of all the forces that we were living through.
Correct.
Even I, who was born in the 50s, have a different perspective than I might have had if I were born today.
Right.
But it doesn't change the value of these things. And that's why I'm so glad that we're looking at and listening to these wonderful fragments of history.
Exactly. Well, and in the case of The Man, you said 1972, because that's when the film came out. The book came out in 1964.
Right.
So the book, I would think, I don't know when he started writing the book and that sort of thing, but it could have easily been right after the death of Kennedy that he's writing this thing. And at the time going, oh, what would, in your brain, kind of a what if scenario, what if somewhere along that chain there was what if there had been a black vice president? What if there had been somebody before? I mean, in the case now that we go up to 2020, it looks like we're going to end up with a black vice president, if a woman, a black vice president. And then what if we lose Biden? Then all of a sudden we have a black female president for the first one. And that's an interesting piece that would have been, you know, fiction for sure back in the day. And now it's our reality. So what an interesting time we live in. Well, I think that's a great place for us to stop. I hope you enjoy these Orson Welles commentaries. Yet again, I think this is one that was lost to time. And it's the first time folks have heard it since in 75 years. So I hope you're going to enjoy this episode. Next week is one of the big ones that I've been talking about. I think next week is the one that talks about the lobbyists and focuses on the lobbyists in Washington. And so we'll be probably having a lot to talk about with that and how many lobbyists there are now, because there were just way too many lobbyists when there were however many thousands there were back then. And now I'm going to try and find out that figure. Hopefully Terry will look that up and Kathy and one of us will be able to find out how many lobbyists there are currently in Washington, D.C. versus back then. but we will leave that for you for next week. So enjoy.
Orson Welles speaking. I broke a promise on the last broadcast. The jazz crowded out the fairy story. We'll have the fairy story today after a little gossip and a couple of rumors about this fantastic world of reality. We'll get to that in just a minute.
The name Men Fly By. That's the way people who know refer to Lear Incorporated, the sponsors of this program. For Lear has been famous for more than 15 years for the fine aircraft radios they make. Radios that are flying the airways from coast to coast and from Alaska to the tip of South America. You know well how dependable, how up to the minute, how sensitive and fine such radios have to be. And that's the kind of radio making that Lear understands and does superlatively well. The Lear home radios, which you'll be seeing soon, share this kind of expert manufacture. They'll be unusually fine radios. They'll be equipped to bring you the very latest developments in entertainment. Just to mention one, there's the Lear wire recorder, the wire that remembers. With this, you can record everything you wish, even radio programs, right from the air. A whole hour or more of entertainment goes on a single spool, ready to be played and replayed to your heart's content. On the other hand, whatever you don't want anymore disappears from the wire the moment you record something else on top of it. Well, that's the kind of development you'll see and hear in Lear radios. So be on the watch for the radios with the name Lear, L-E-A-R. Now, Mr. Welles brings you his views and opinions on events as he sees them. The opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of Lear Incorporated.
If you liked our broadcast of and about jazz last week, you should have heard my musician friends when they really warmed up after we got off the air and had breakfast. It's early out here on the coast, early anywhere for a jam session, but we had one out on the terrace to the amazement and edification of the neighborhood. Zudy Singleton, the drummer, the world's greatest drummer, I should say, had planned to say a few words on the show, but it was too early for that entirely. Man, said Zudy, my diction is beat this morning. Come television, I'll give you a look at the gentleman who gave his name to the American language, the original Zooty of the exclamation Zoot and of Zoot Suits. He's, by the way, neither an exclamatory personality nor what even Sumner Welles would describe as a snappy dresser. Well, it's much quieter around here today, and the atmosphere is more conducive to fairy tales. Of course, we can't neglect the news altogether. As a matter of fact, the news itself is beginning to look a little like a great big fairy story without a happy ending. When the rumor was launched that Clement Attlee was proposing a whirlpooling of scientific knowledge to control the atom, the most surprised man, I hear, in Great Britain was Winston Churchill, who up to now, as you know, has dominated the foreign policy of the government he no longer heads. Just recently, Winnie made this private crack. Attlee is a sheep in sheep's clothing. Well, last week, Mr. Attlee came to call at the White House for a chat about the atom. The published decisions of the Prime Minister and the President, in my opinion, make a mockery of the San Francisco Conference and knock the last real prop from under the prematurely rickety United Nations organization. I have it on excellent authority that there are certain men around Truman who feel we should attack and devastate Russia before Russia has time to develop the atom bomb. Doubtful that America can actually fire the first shot, these men hope for some incident that might make it possible for the Soviet Union to be accused of aggression. I have reason to fear that Admiral Leahy is among those who feel that war with Russia is inevitable and therefore desirable now. The admiral, who has more combined military and diplomatic experience than any other man in Washington, is said to have even greater influence over Truman today than he used to have over Roosevelt. Those who want war with Russia and want it now are saying that Soviet moral prestige in Europe is at a low ebb, that for the moment Russia is a hollow shell militarily and no match for us until Soviet scientists manage to build their version of the atomic infernal machine. All this may sound pretty wild, but these are wild times, and there are some desperate men in Washington today. According to a current joke, Stalin made two mistakes, showing the Red Army to Central Europe and showing Central Europe to the Red Army. One more item, and our joke department will close up for the day. The latest rumor is that Harry Truman is grooming himself for a new job. It isn't a second term he's after, nor is it the presidency of the United Nations organization, that higher office they used to link with Franklin Roosevelt's name. No, it's being hinted in Washington that Harry Truman is grooming himself to run for governor of Missouri in 1948. Well, where I'm sitting, it's a fine sunny day. Every prospect pleases, and even man in this whiny Hollywood weather is not so vile. Below this microphone is a swimming pool, and beyond are the swimming pools of neighbors. It's all very sumptuous in a cozy sort of way, and I don't mind telling you I'm ashamed of it. Next door to me, on the charred continent of Europe, men and women and children are starving to death. Next door to me, in tragic Asia, British troops, armed in part by American Lend-Lease, are fighting Indonesian patriots who are fighting for a thing known in the English language as freedom. We fought for it ourselves, and so have the British. But the British at this moment are fighting for their empire. And they fought for that before, and fought for it here, as I can't help remembering, when America was a part of that empire, in 1778, when we were on the Indonesian side of that old argument. Like the man says, when you get rich, you forget what it was like to be poor. Our own government, which maintained to the huge advantage of the dictator Franco and the fascist world conspiracy the strictest neutrality in the Spanish Civil War, is very openly and very definitely taking sides in the civil war now raging in China. I think we'd better change the subject. I think we'd better have the fairy story now. Probably you've heard the one I'm going to read you. I hope so, because a fairy tale gets better as you know it better. This one is called, very beautifully, Briar Rose. A long time ago, there was a king and a queen who said every day, "Ah, if we only could have a child," but they never had one. It happened that once when the queen was bathing, a frog crept out of the water onto the land and said to her, "Your wish shall be fulfilled. Before a year has gone by, you shall have a daughter." What the frog said came true, and the queen had a little girl who was so pretty that the king could not contain himself for joy and ordered a great feast. He invited not only his kindred, friends, and acquaintances, but also the wise women in order that they might be kind and well-disposed towards the child. There were 13 of these wise women in his kingdom, but as he had only 12 golden plates for them to eat out of, one of them had to be left at home. The feast came to an end, and the wise women bestowed their magic gifts upon the baby. One gave virtue, another beauty, a third riches, and so on with everything in the world that one can wish for. When 11 of them had made their promises, suddenly the 13th wise woman came in. She wished to avenge herself for not having been invited, and without greeting or even looking at anyone, she cried with a loud voice, "The king's daughter shall, in her 15th year, prick herself with a spindle and fall down dead." And without saying a word more, she turned round and left the room. They were all shocked, but the 12th wise woman, whose good wish still remained unspoken, came forward, and as she could not undo the evil sentence, but only soften it, she said, "It shall not be death, but a deep sleep of 100 years, into which the princess shall fall." The king, who would fain keep his dear child from the misfortune, gave orders that every spindle in the whole kingdom should be burnt. And meanwhile, the gifts of the wise women were plenteously fulfilled on the young girl, for she was so beautiful, modest, good-natured, and wise that everyone who saw her was bound to love her. It happened that on the very day when she was 15 years old, the king and queen were not at home, and the maiden was left in the palace quite alone. She went round into all sorts of places, looking into rooms and bedchambers just as she liked, and at last came to an old tower. She climbed up the narrow, winding staircase and reached a little door. A rusty key was in the lock, and when she turned it, the door sprang open, and there sat an old woman with a spindle, busily spinning her flax. "Good day, old mother," said the king's daughter. "What are you doing there?" "I am spinning," said the old woman, and nodded her head. "What sort of thing is that that rattles round so merrily?" said the girl, and she took the spindle and wanted to spin too. But scarcely had she touched the spindle when the magic decree was fulfilled, and she pricked her finger with it. And in the very moment when she felt the prick, she fell down upon the bed and lay in a deep sleep. And this sleep extended over the whole palace. The king and queen who had just come home and had entered the great hall began to go to sleep, and the whole of the court with them. The horses, too, went to sleep in the stable, the dogs in the yard, the pigeons upon the roof, the flies on the wall. Even the fire that was flaming on the hearth became quiet and slept. The roast meat left off frizzling, and the cook, who was just going to pull the hair of the scullery boy because he had forgotten something, let him go and went to sleep. And the wind fell, and on the trees before the castle, not a leaf moved again.
But round about the castle there began to grow a hedge of thorns, which every year became higher, and at last grew close up round the castle and all over it, so that there was nothing of it to be seen, not even the flag upon the roof. And after long, long years, a king's son came again to that country and heard an old man talking about the thorn hedge, and that a castle was said to stand behind it, in which a wonderfully beautiful princess named Briar Rose had been asleep for 100 years, and that the king and queen and the whole court were asleep likewise. He had heard, too, from his grandfather that many king's sons had already come and had tried to get through the thorny hedge, but they had remained sticking fast in it and had died a pitiful death. Then the youth said, "I am not afraid. I will go and see the beautiful Briar Rose." By this time, the 100 years had just passed, and the day had come when Briar Rose was to wake again. And when the king's son came near to the thorn hedge, it was nothing but large and beautiful flowers, which parted from each other of their own accord and let him pass unhurt. And they closed again behind him like a hedge. In the castle yard, he saw the horses and the spotted hounds lying asleep. On the roof sat the pigeons with their heads under their wings. And when he entered the house, the flies were asleep upon the wall. The cook in the kitchen was still holding out his hand to seize the boy. And the maid was sitting by the black hen, which he was going to pluck. He went on farther, and in the great hall he saw the whole of the court lying asleep, and by the throne lay the king and queen. Then he went on still farther, and all was so quiet that a breath could be heard. And at last he came to the tower, and opened the door into the little room where Briar Rose was sleeping. And there she lay, so beautiful that he could not turn his eyes away from her. And he stooped down and gave her a kiss. But as soon as he kissed her, Briar Rose opened her eyes and awoke and looked at him quite sweetly. Then they went down together, and the king awoke, and the queen, and the whole court, and looked at each other in great astonishment. And the horses in the courtyard stood up and shook themselves. The hounds jumped up and wagged their tails. The pigeons upon the roof pulled out their heads from under their wings and looked around and flew into the open country. The flies on the wall crept again. The fire in the kitchen burned up and flickered and cooked the meat. The joint began to turn and sizzle again. And the cook gave the boy such a box on the ear that he screamed. And the maid finished plucking the fowl. And then the marriage of the king's son with Briar Rose was celebrated with all splendor, and they lived contented to the end of their days. And that's the end of the fairy tale. And now your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
You'll probably notice that when I say Lear Home Radios, I emphasize the word home. Well, that's to distinguish these particular radios from the famous aircraft radios that Lear has been making since way back in 1930. And it's also to point out that all the outstanding skill and craftsmanship that have gone into these radios for airplanes are now shared in Lear radios that you'll have for your homes. You'll find Lear home radios are handsome, fine-looking pieces of furniture. They're complete with the latest advances the radio world offers. Some of them will have television, some an entirely new contribution to convenience and tuning, some the Lear wire recorder I told you about before, and there'll be FM and worldwide shortwave. About the prices? Ah, there's the surprise. Lear radios, with all their background and fine manufacture, will not be high-priced. A beautiful console combination with every feature, including television, runs about $500. And a trim, capable table model sells at the $19.95 level. But no matter what you pay for a Lear radio, one thing is certain. When you see it and hear it, you'll agree that you get the most for your investment in a radio made by Lear, L-E-A-R. And now a final word from Orson Welles.
Well, it isn't too early to begin thinking about Christmas, and may I suggest that you order from Pantheon Books or from your bookstore the truly great new edition of Grimm's Fairy Tales, illustrated by Joseph Cherrel, and from which I read you the story of Briar Rose. After you've looked at that book, I think you'll probably want to keep it, so you'd better get two books right off the bat, the second for the best friend you have in the world, preferably an adult. If he doesn't like it, he doesn't deserve your friendship, or if it's a she and she thinks the Grimm brothers wrote only for children, she'll change your mind, or you'll change your mind about her.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.
1030 at KECA, Los Angeles, transcribed.
We always shop at the makeup and eat, the makeup and eat, the makeup